tiger!
Ora, ora.
Hello, I'm Hanea Ahu, bringing you The Week in Parliament with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon. The House is adjourned this week, MPs taking a short break before tackling the annual big-ticket item of the budget. It will be the seventh that Bill English has delivered as National's Finance Minister. He'll be doing that at 2pm next Thursday. And that marks the start of a 15-hour debate, which could take them through to the start of the next adjournment on Thursday, June the 4th. Already, the budget has been the source of much debate and many questions, including this one last Tuesday for the Prime Minister, John Key, from Opposition Leader Andrew Little.
My question is to the Prime Minister. Does he stand by his statement in relation to achieving a surplus that it is like, quotes, landing a 747 on a pinhead, end quotes?
Speaker.
All right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Yes, because history shows that fiscal forecasts and outturn moves move around quite substantially. For example, in Budget 2008, the then Minister of Finance was forecasting a $1.3 billion Obergul surplus in 2008-09. As it turned out, he left the government books in deficit by $3.9 billion that year, and Treasury told us we faced never-ending deficits under the previous government's policies. So, yes, forecasts can move around a lot, but this government is making good progress on fixing up the hash of it that Labor made.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why is he trying to minimise the importance of achieving a surplus this year when he's made it a core part of his government's credibility for the past 4 years? Why can't he just admit he's failed?
Honourable Prime Minister.
We're trying to minimise it. We are pointing out that there are a number of factors that make it a little bit trickier, and that is, for instance, that inflation is so much lower, which is great for consumers, that there are a number of areas where there's been revaluation by the Treasury. But, Mr Speaker, if we just take a step back for a moment and say, in 2011, what was the deficit? The answer was $18.4 billion. The HIFU forecast for this year's deficit is $585 million. And I will point out that every single attempt to either raise revenue or cut expenditure by this government has been opposed by the Labor opposition.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Does he accept he would now likely be on track to surplus if his government hadn't spent $36,000 on sending ministers to Northland, hadn't wasted tens of millions of dollars on NovaPay, hadn't lost hundreds of millions of dollars in dividends due to the asset sales, and wasn't blowing the budget on everything from charter schools to IRD computers?
Yes. Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, no. I will point out that NovaPay was something that came along under the previous Labor government. And, Mr Speaker, when it comes to the hundreds of millions of...
Order. I can't hear the answer with that sort of noise. With the Prime Minister...
Mr Speaker, when it comes to the hundreds of millions of dollars more that we might have got under the mixed ownership model, that was money that was literally blown by the reckless policies of the Labor opposition, so firmly rejected by the New Zealand public.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
When will he admit that his government, acting as a bystander at the dairy auctions rather than building a more diverse economy, is the real reason his economic promises are falling away as fast as the milk price?
Mr Speaker,
right, Honourable
Speaker,
Prime Minister.
I don't know if I misinterpreted the question from the Leader of the Opposition, but he seems to be saying that the government should be in there buying milk powder in the auction. If he does, that's an interesting use of government resources.
And the Prime Minister faced more questions from Andrew Little last Tuesday, as Tom Fruin reports in his summary of the week in the House.
Our Parliament has 121 MPs, but only one PM. That's John Key, back in the House on Tuesday, for the first time in over a month, to face eagerly awaited questions about pulling the ponytail of a waitress at his local cafe. They began rather obliquely with this one from Opposition Leader Andrew Little.
Does he enforce high standards of conduct on all his ministers, including himself?
Speaker.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, yes, however, with respect to my actions at Apana or CAF, my conduct clearly upset the staff member in question. I sincerely apologise to her at the time. I became aware of that and I've continued to do so publicly.
Mr Little then probed closer to the root of the hair-pulling issue.
Does he accept that through his embarrassing and weird behaviour, he has now made the office of Prime Minister of New Zealand an international laughingstock?
Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, no, but I do accept I have to take responsibility for my own actions.
Next day, the Prime Minister was keen to accept responsibility for more than just his own actions.
Well, actually, I will take responsibility for the fact that the economy's growing. We've got the fifth highest employment rate in the OECD, that New Zealanders are flocking back to New Zealand, having left in droves under the previous Labor government.
Which Mr Key continued to blame for the country's economic woes in his answer to this question from Andrew Little.
Having failed to keep his promise to get the books into surplus this year, will he guarantee New Zealanders that he won't be breaking any other promises?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I think New Zealanders are smart enough to work out that this is a government that's picked up a hell of a mess from the previous Labor government. A disaster that they inherited. A pile of unfunded programs. And frankly, economic leadership that would be welcomed in Greece but actually isn't welcomed in New Zealand and has tidied the shop up.
The Prime Minister also faced questions from the opposition leader on a report from the Auditor General critical of the Whānau Ora program and its spending of a third of its budget on its own administration.
After the $42 million spent on administration and the untold millions eaten up by service providers, how much Whānau Ora money is actually reaching families in need?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I don't have the exact number, but I can quote the Auditor General's report, where she talks about the success Whānau Ora has had for many families that they spoke to.
Questions about Whānau Ora on Wednesday were followed by a request to the Speaker for a snap debate.
While the release of an Auditor General report will not always warrant an urgent debate, on this occasion I consider the need to maintain public confidence in programs such as Whānau Ora justifies the setting of aside of the business of the House today.
The request for the urgent debate came from Labor's Māori Development spokeswoman, Nanaia Mahuta.
Quite simply, Mr Speaker, there was a number of areas in which the funds set aside for Whānau Ora didn't go to the people who needed it most.
While the choice of groups who did get funding became the source of questions for the Minister for Whānau Ora and Māori Development, Te Uaroa Flavel. Among them was this one on Thursday from New Zealand First MP Peter Poroni.
Can the Minister guarantee that the changes already made to Whānau Ora ensure public funds can no longer go towards events such as Otaki's Rahui Rugby Club's $60,000 one-day hui? And if not, why not?
Mr Flavel said he'd be taking a closer look at funding proposals.
But in the end, we have commissioned certain outcomes from the commissioning agencies. We expect those outcomes to be delivered.
Back in the snap debate, Mr Flavel rejected allegations of misspending.
99% of the funding intended for whānau and providers reached their hands.
Matiria Ture, co-leader of the Green Party, said Whānau Ora had enormous potential.
But Whānau Ora is at great risk of a death by a thousand cuts due to mishandling by the Minister and TPK and by a lack of commitment from government agencies. That is what this Auditor General's report shows really clearly.
New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters was less equivocal.
The spending on Whānau Ora is completely politically motivated. 4 years after its inception, the program is still a byword for the squandering of public money. Now, the sad thing is there are some great Māori deliverers and providers out there who had their programs taken off them, who were sidelined or had to come under the umbrella of Whānau Ora. And what we've got to say today is it's got no concern with respect to them. They are doing a fine job. But what we've got to say today, it's offensive to the many Māori who are struggling to pay their bills, find work and raise their children. It's offensive to all taxpayers who are seeing money that could be spent on worthwhile purposes being squandered to indulge the Māori Party and its cronies.
Rallying to the defence of the Māori Party, Social Development Minister Ann Tolley delivered a broadside across the chamber at Labor's front bench.
Those three guys sitting there, middle-aged white Pākehā men, who have been in this house for too long, have no idea the courage it took the Māori Party to put up and make this program work. They have no idea, because Phil Goff led was part of two governments that did nothing for Māori, that did nothing. nothing to advance those options and opportunities for those families. And they sit there now and they can't.
Social Development Minister Anne Tolley, while Winston Peters was next to be found in one of the committee rooms, devising a way of sabotaging the first flag referendum and avoiding the need for a second.
In a submission to the Justice and Electoral Committee on Thursday, Mr Peters suggested an option for people opposed to the referendum.
All opponents of this bill have to do is write on their referendum paper, "We want our flag." That's all they have to do. Their vote then becomes informal, and if sufficient numbers do, that then means informals, which is after all a choice, will outnumber the next highest choice of flag design. How credible then will the process be, and you will not have a credible reason to go into a second referendum?
Winston Peters taking the unusual step for a party leader of making a submission to a select committee said reversing the order of the referendums would save money.
Now we say, if a referendum is to be forced upon the taxpayers, then the first referendum must ask this simple question. Do you want to change the New Zealand flag, yes or no? If it's no, then we will stop there and save tens of millions of dollars.
And Winston Peters' sentiments echoed another item of business before the committee earlier in the morning, when another Member of Parliament, Labour's Trevor Mallard, presented his petition, signed by over 30,000 people, calling for the inclusion of a question in the first flag referendum, asking as to whether voters wanted a change of flag or not.
Every party represented at the cross-party group, other than the National Party, wanted to have a yes-no vote as the first vote on the referendum process. That is the system that was used when we had our electoral reform decision. We had a yes-no vote. At the same time, we had a list of alternatives. My view is that that system could be used for the flag and should be used for the flag. So right at the beginning is a decision about whether or not we want to have a change.
Mr Mallard also said his proposal would save money.
About $13 million on the second referendum. I think there are better ways of spending that money. For example, you could get about 1,300 illiterate adults to read. You could get about 250 families a grant which would pay the deposit for them to own their own house. So there are some really good things that you could do with $13 million, which are much better than what I am now seeing as a vanity project, rather than something which is really asking the opinions of New Zealanders.
Trevor Mallard presenting his petition on the New Zealand flag referendums bill to the Justice and Electoral Committee on Thursday. The bill is due to be reported back to the House by the 29th of July. And a day earlier, on Wednesday, the Law and Order Committee heard submissions on a bill which would enable the Department of Corrections and Police to carry out drug and alcohol testing on offenders on home detention, as well as people on bail, if they are subject to court conditions prohibiting drug and alcohol use. The first submission on the bill came from Law Society spokesman Graham Edgler, who questioned whether police were adequately qualified to impose drug testing.
Certainly, there are some people for whom, if you're going to have alcohol or drug testing, it's a reasonable thing to do, but the way in which it's done and who orders it is important. And so if you've got a question of whether someone's wearing like an alcohol bracelet or something like that, that's a pretty major infringement on liberty that, you know, judges are very careful because that's a major imposition on liberty. So allowing that to automatically happen or leaving that up to police we think is a problem.
Later, Mr Edgler fielded questions from Law and Order Committee members, including National MP Ian McKelvey.
What I was really trying to get at was, seemed to me that we're adding a layer of bureaucracy or judicial oversight to something that we've already got the judicial oversight of, given the commentary you've put in here.
A judge can say you shouldn't drink alcohol. Police can turn up on your knock on your door at 6 o'clock at night and say, blow into this. That's one thing. But a judge not being involved in the decision of should this person have an electronically monitored bracelet 24/7 is a different question.
Law Society spokesman Graham Edgler answering questions there from National's Ian McKelvey. during submissions on the drug and alcohol testing of community-based offenders and Bailey's legislation bill. And that bill is due to be reported back to the House by the 10th of September.
That's report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the chamber after leading off the snap debate on Wednesday, Nanaia Mahuta was back on her feet on Thursday with this request.
I seek leave to move a motion without notice and without debate on the passing of Eri Mahinari.
Is there any objection to that course of action? There is none. The Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the New Zealand Labour Party, we'd like to acknowledge the contribution of a great New Zealander. Eri Mahinari sadly passed early hours this morning. He was just here yesterday afternoon to witness the swearing-in of a fellow member, Rhea Bond, a Ngāti Hine kinsman.
And Rhea Bond delivered her maiden speech on Wednesday.
Firstly, I wish to congratulate the New Zealand First Party, our leader, the Right Honourable Winston Peters, with his landslide victory in winning the Northland seat,
which enabled Mr Peters to resign his list seat, creating the vacancy that was filled by Rhea Bond, the next name on the party's list. And the filling of another vacancy was announced on Thursday by the Speaker, David Carter.
Honourable members, I'm pleased to announce that pursuant to Section 7 of the Clerk of the House of Representatives Act 1988, His Excellency the Governor-General has appointed David Martin Wilson as the Clerk of the House of Representatives for a term of 7 years commencing 6 July 2015.
Mr Carter then called on the Leader of the House to deliver his weekly business statement.
The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, well,
not yet.
We all know who the boss is. Mr Speaker, may I first congratulate Mr Wilson on his appointment. It did sound a little bit like a sentence, the way you read it out, but I'm sure the 7 years will pass successfully and that he'll grow into the role of clerk, filling a long history of excellent clerks who've provided service to this House in the past. I'm sure we'll have an occasion to farewell our existing clerk when her appointment finally comes to an end. Mr Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday the 19th of May, the Government will look to progress a number of bills, including the New Zealand Superannuation and Retirement Income Amendment Bill and the Waitangi National Trust Board Amendment Bill. Thursday the 21st of May will be Budget Day.
As has become the custom, Mr Brownlee's business statement was followed by a comment from his opposition shadow, Labour's Chief Whip, Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, can I simply add to the Leader of the House's acknowledgement of the new and departing Clerk of the House and wish both of them well. We certainly recognise the importance of the role of the Office of the Clerk here as a sort of an impartial adjudicator in the proceedings of the House and ensuring that the House continues to run smoothly, despite whatever attempts we may make to thwart that. We acknowledge that the Clerk has a very important role in making sure that this House and the authority of this House is respected and upheld.
David Wilson began his parliamentary career in 1994 as a Select Committee report writer, and he'll be just the fourth Clerk of the House in modern times, which started in 1976 with Charles Littlejohn. He was succeeded by his deputy, David McGee, in 1985, and he served until the appointment of Mary Harris in 2007. Three clerks in nearly 40 years, during which there were eight Prime Ministers and a dozen Speakers. With the final word this week from the current one, David Carter.
I hereby present the Register of Pecuniary and Other Specified Interests of Members of Parliament, summary of annual returns as at 31 January 2015.
More details on who owns what from our website, parliamenttoday.co.nz.
Thanks, Tom. Last week you promised to bring us any new developments in the ongoing conflict between the Speaker and opposition MPs over the tabling of documents in the Chamber.
Yes, on Tuesday, after the House had congratulated the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge on the birth of baby Charlotte, the Speaker delivered on a commitment he'd made last week.
Last Thursday, Matilda Ture raised a point of order seeking my advice on the procedure for seeking leave to table a document. To assist members, I have given this further consideration and I've also examined the rulings of previous speakers. What I will require of members when seeking leave to table a document is three things. that the members identify these three things in this order: the source of the document, when it was published or produced, and very succinctly inform the House of its nature. This way, an informed decision can be made by members as to whether the document should in fact be tabled. Seeking leave to table a document is not an opportunity to make a political statement a member wishes to be heard. It is intended to place before the House material that informs members of matters that are not otherwise readily available to them. Briefly describing for the House the nature of the document is not an opportunity to quote passages from it. If members persist in doing so, the leave will not be put to the House.
The Speaker then heard from the opposition's shadow Leader of the House, Labor's Chief Whip, Chris Hipkins.
Point of order, Chris Hipkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. That's a considered ruling, and I understand the point that you're raising. The only challenge for members in describing the document is, I think there must be some necessity to explain the relevance for tabling the document at that point. Otherwise, we can get into a situation where members can be seeking to table all sorts of things. And part of the narrowing down of the rules around tabling was to prevent that from happening. So whilst the description does need to be succinct, it also needs to relate the nature of the document to whether it's a question or the speech in question. Otherwise, it is simply a pointless exercise.
I think my ruling is very clear. There's an opportunity to succinctly describe the nature of the document, and that may be, on various occasions, that will require more depth than on other occasions. But I repeat the point, it's not the opportunity for members to make a political statement, which I see it being used for on many occasions. And if I sense that that's the purpose of the members seeking to table the document, it's likely the leave will not be put in the first place.
The Speaker, David Carter, who also delivered this ruling on a request he received on Wednesday for an urgent debate on the Auditor-General's report on the Whānau Order Programme.
I have received a letter from the Honourable Nanaia Mahuta seeking to debate Understanding Order 389. Some issues with Whānau Ora revealed in the report by the Controller and Auditor-General on Whānau Ora the first 4 years. The release of the report is a particular case of recent occurrence. As an Auditor-General's report, there is no ministerial responsibility for the report, though I do accept that it deals with matters involving ministerial responsibility. The House has in place a procedure to consider reports from Officers of Parliament. They stand referred to select committees for consideration and report. Any such select committee report is set down for consideration as a member's order of the day. But this may take some time. Ultimately, a debate on the committee's report may provide an opportunity to consider the quality of the government's response. However, serious issues have been raised. While the release of an Auditor-General report will not always warrant an urgent debate, on this occasion, I consider the need to maintain public confidence in programs such as Whānau Ora justifies the setting of aside of the business of the House today.
The Speaker, David Carter. Now, here's the mystery voice.
The Week in Parliament. Mystery voice.
It was not my decision whether or not to hear from form submitters. It was a decision of the committee not to hear oral evidence from those who submitted a form submission.
Who is the mystery voice? Here it is again.
The Week in Parliament. Mystery voice.
It was not my decision whether or not to hear from form submitters. It was a decision of the committee not to hear oral evidence from those who submitted a form submission.
I'll be back with the identity of the mystery voice later in the program. First, though, Rhys Lyon reports on the only bill passed last week.
The third reading of the Animal Welfare Amendment Bill was interrupted when the House adjourned for the week last Thursday, and with 5 minutes remaining in his speech, Labour's Trevor Mallard resumed the debate where he left off, complaining that the enforcement date for the bill was too far away.
So practices which this minister accepts are cruel and must go, don't have to go for another 15 years. And in my opinion, Mr Speaker, that is just not good enough.
Trevor Mallard was followed by National Party backbencher and member for Rangitike, Ian McKelvey.
Gives me no great pleasure to follow the expert from Hutt South on animals. He clearly is an expert on life and times of the mower, but knows very little about farm animals, in my view. I just wanted to make a couple of comments on the comments he just made, because I think it's grossly unfair to include all farmers in the general statements that he just made. And I certainly admit there are farmers who aren't perfect, Mr Speaker. But I also want to make the point that I think they do a pretty good job on the whole, and we certainly do our best to work within the rules.
The bill has been before Parliament for 2 years, and Mr McKelvey is on the Primary Production Committee, which considered it.
This bill is a very important, as I said, part of what we do. Been around for a while. We considered 1,721 submissions in the course of this bill, 12 industry groups, 20 advocacy groups and 8 professional bodies. It was a pretty big job. I think on the whole, the committee did an outstanding job with this bill, and I'm very pleased to see it coming through.
Following Ian McKelvey was New Zealand First's Richard Prosser.
I want to talk primarily about the export of live animals, because it's probably the major lingering concern that New Zealand First still has with regards to this bill. The issue of live exports for slaughter has not gone away, Mr Speaker, and in fact it's raised its head only in this last week just gone with the Prime Minister's efforts towards securing a free trade deal with the nations of the Middle East Gulf Cooperation Council. This deal has been on hold since 2009, and coincidentally one of the sticking points is the fact that New Zealand halted live sheep exports in 2004. Apparently an investor from Saudi Arabia lost quite a bit of money as a result of the cessation of exports, and we're told that the Saudis are still a wee bit sore about that. But that aside, these exports were put on indefinite hold at that time for very good reason. And as a nation, we had engaged in live export for slaughter for more than 20 years prior to that. But in 2003, something like 5,000 sheep died on one ship under what could only be described as quite horrific conditions while being transported from Australia to Saudi Arabia. And they died from heat stress, overcrowding, lack of food, water and sanitation during a sea voyage which had lasted something like 2 months longer than it should have done. And so New Zealand First is very much concerned that such exports may be resumed and that provision for the resumption still exists under the bill.
The bill passed that final reading without vote.
Rhys Lyon reporting on the third reading of the Animal Welfare Amendment Bill. That was the only government bill passed last week. Although progress was made on local, private and a members bill on Wednesday, none got through to their final stage. Now, once more, here's the mystery voice.
The Week in Parliament. Mystery voice.
It was not my decision whether or not to hear from form submitters. It was a decision of the committee not to hear oral evidence from those who submitted a form submission.
And that's Nationals member for Waitaki, Jackie Ding. She chairs the Justice and Electoral Select Committee, and in that clip, she was answering a question in the House from Labour's Trevor Mallard about submissions on the flag referendums bill. Now we've just time for a little more from Rhea Bond's maiden speech on Wednesday.
My interest in politics started at the age of 7. I used to sit on the floor of my family home, listening to the radiogram, to the booming voice of Sir Robert Muldoon. With his infectious laugh, and to most children, a pretty scary sounding voice, but not me. I never knew what the problems were at the age of 7. All I knew was that I liked his strength and his character from his voice and watching him on the news.
New Zealand First newest MP, Rhea Bond. More on our webpage, Parliament Today, all one word, .co.nz. I'm Hanea Ahu, and I'll be back with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon and another report from Parliament at the same time next week.